Black Clock Audio Tales, edited by Daniel Spitzer. Black Clock Audio Tales is a PGTTCM production. Join us in our exploration of old ghost stories, supernatural fiction, horror tales, folk tales, fantasy, the gothic tradition, weird tales, and cosmic horror. Look for the podcast behind the loose brick on the north end of the Black Clock Tower, or wherever you find your podcasts. We suggest Podbean or Apple Podcasts. Help keep Black Clock Audio Tales running smoothly by donating $5 to $10 to paypal.me/pgttcm. The title track is
The Chamber
by Kevin MacLeod. Find us on the web at pgttcm.com and at Black Clock Audio on Instagram, Twitter, and the Facebook. And Black Clock Audio Tales on YouTube. Welcome to Black Clock Audio Tales.
Going to be talking about Dracula, as we've got some Dracula coming up on the show. And we're going to be talking with Ken Height about Dracula. And first, Ken, not everyone knows who you are. Could you tell us who you are?
It seems so odd when you just say it out like that blank. Yeah, your excuse is that I'm primarily in the tabletop role-playing game business. I mostly make role-playing games, some of them about Cthulhu, Trail of Cthulhu from Pograin Press, and other books in that series, Bookhounds of London, Fall of Delta Green, most recently, for Pograin in the Cthulhu universe. And then also, I have a role-playing game of Burned Spies versus Vampires called Knights Black Agents, which had as a capstone, gigantic heartbreaker door stopper of a campaign, a little something that I like to call the Dracula dossier that I did with Gareth Ryder Hanrahan, my co-designer on it, which set up the notion that Dracula was actually a redacted after-action report of a failed British intelligence mission to recruit a vampire in 1894, and that they kept attempting to go back to that well in 1940 and in 1977, and then again in the modern day, they successfully, they think, have recruited him to go and hunt the enemies of Great Britain, who turn out to be mostly Muslim crusaders, the same kind of people that he fought back in the day. So you'd think that's a marriage made in heaven, except, of course, it involves Dracula. So the player characters stumble on the original Dracula, full of all of the secrets of MI6, and use that to hunt him down and, one hopes, kill him for good. And that's sort of the big thing. So for about a year and a half, I was living, breathing, sleeping Dracula. I produced that. I produced The Thrill of Dracula, which is my guide to Dracula as presented since then, since 1476 when he died, all the ways that he's shown up in movies and in mythology, and the fact that Stoker's Dracula is not the same as our buddy Vlad Tepes, but they have some similarities, among them being jerks. So that's where I come down on Dracula.
Yeah, no, I've been listening to your podcast and recently came across Icelandic and Swedish Dracula, so that was interesting.
Yeah, we the podcast is Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff that I do with my cohort Robin Laws, a fellow game designer and author. And yes, the recent discovery that there was a Swedish manuscript of Dracula that was the basis for the translation, and turns out to have been a much freer translation, and that it very much departs from the story and adds a bunch of stuff in it. That was recently discovered and translated, and then once that became a big thing, a scholar in Sweden said, oh, is it anything like Swedish Dracula that predates it? And it turns out, yeah, it kind of is. So we're all now, well, I guess the Swedes aren't, they can read it now, but the rest of the world is eagerly awaiting a translation of the Swedish Dracula, which looks like it may be the Ur-Scandinavian Dracula that was created by some journalist or writer in Sweden, with perhaps, and this is the part that gets everyone excited, but perhaps with the cooperation of Bram Stoker. Although the Icelandic one does not necessarily slot very closely into the notes that we know that Stoker prepared before and while writing Dracula. Those have been published. They're in the Rosenbach Museum in Philadelphia. You could go look at them, or you could buy the not cheap book of them. And there are some elements that are in the Scandinavian Dracula, or at least in the Icelandic one, like the notion that Dracula has a cult of rich Satanist followers, but who they are and what their roles are is not at all the same between the notes and the new version. So it does look like either a Scandinavian journalist or Stoker himself took a second bite at that apple, as it were.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. The notion that we've all been, you know, trickling along talking about the same novel for 100 years, and again, it's a work of art. You people have been talking about Romeo and Juliet for 400 years, and they're not tired of that yet. So you can talk about Dracula forever, but the notion that there's this whole other possible resource, this whole possible well of almost contemporaneous treatment of the topic is super interesting, I think.
Another question I have for you is Dracula as a fictional versus historical, like who is this notion of Dracula that we have, and how does it reflect against like the actual son of the dragon or dragon son? Or
well, I mean, the name Dracula that Stoker used came from a very confused and bad history of Romania that he read in the library, basically in the lending library at Whitby. And it was a history of the Balkan countries or something like the Wallachia and the surrounding countries. And it mentioned in a very sort of compressed paragraph the story of the Wallachian resistance to the invading Turks, and mentioned a prince named Dracula. Got a lot of the details wrong, and then explains in a footnote that Dracula is the common Romanian name for the devil, and for anyone who is especially cursed or evil is called Dracula. And so Stoker, we think, looked at that footnote and said, well, that must be what they call my vampire, who at that time, of course, was named Count Vampire in the draft, that not being the giant giveaway that it would have become later. Welcome to my house. I'm Count Vampire. Oh my God, look at that. Is that the time? I gotta go. But anyway, and then he sort of may have gone back to that, or may have found some other source for the very little bit of Balkan history that he works into the novel. And if you've read the novel, you note, for example, that our Dracula, novel Dracula, is Hungarian, not Romanian. He was an alchemist, which the real Vlad Tepes was not. There's one element about attacking across the river by surprise, which people have been able to find in Vlad Tepes's campaigns. But again, find any captain in military history who has not attacked across a river to achieve surprise, and you'd be the first one to find him. So there's elements in there that probably came out of Stoker's either memory of that book or his notes from that book or his sort of confused version of whatever source he did find in the British Museum or British Library at the time. And but he didn't bother to connect the dots. And he mentions in the novel a Van Helsing's colleague, Vambery, or Arminius, he calls him, which is probably a reference to Arminius Vambery, who was what they called an Orientalist back in the time, meaning he was a specialist on the linguistics and history of the Near East. And Vambery, at least at one point, spoke to Stoker's Beefsteak Club when he would come back from the Near East and do his little dog and pony show. And so Stoker met Vambery, and Vambery may have filled him in on details of Romanian folklore, the rest of which he got out of a couple of travelogues. So the connection between our Dracula and the coincidentally named guy who impaled a bunch of people and fought the Turks named Dracula, Vladislav for long, Vlad the Third of Wallachia, who was named Vlad Tepes by the Turks because of his habit of impaling people, not necessarily contemporaneously. There's no record that that's what anyone called him, certainly in his hearing. He would have impaled you. That connection was made by a couple of literary historians, mostly named McNally and Florescu, and they wrote a biography of Vlad Tepes, bulked out by the sort of story of Dracula, and it was called In Search of Dracula, which sort of became a big sensation. It was published in 1972, and almost immediately, Richard Matheson, who's the screenwriter of the Jack Palance Dracula, took that historical link and wrote it into his Dracula, so that for the first time in a mainstream English language version, Dracula is presented as the same as our Dracula. Now, a Turkish novel had already done that, writing a novel about Dracula coming to Istanbul instead of to London, that was made into a Turkish movie called Dracula in Istanbul, and that novel had made the connection, but the Turks had Vlad Tepes more on the mind than we did, I guess, for obvious reasons. And so, for that novel, although the incident is the same, it seems like it was more of a, you know, our ancient curse has come back to get us. And someone had rewritten the novel, and instead of it being Count Dracula, turns out to be, I don't know, you know, Sitting Bull, or someone comes back and starts messing with you. You're like, oh, that's not good. That sort of cultural panic in the Turkish literary community. So that's great fun. But the real join of it in sort of the Western world, certainly the English speaking world, comes post Florescu and McNally with Jack Palance's, or Richard Matheson's Jack Palance's Dracula, I should say. And then, of course, Coppola borrowed that wholesale and expanded it even farther for his travesty of a movie. But that connection between the two of them got made over and over and over. There was also a novel, The Dracula Archives, that came out the year before Florescu and McNally's book, by a guy named Raymond Rudorff, that connected Dracula with both Vlad Tepes and Elizabeth Bathory in a sort of a Dracula is awake and conspired and faked the novel kind of way that Fred Saberhagen would eventually use in the Dracula tape. And that if you've read The Annotated Dracula by Les Klinger, he uses that same sort of conceit that Dracula survived the novel and is forcing Stoker to write all these contradictions into it to confuse the trail. And in a way, obviously, that sort of also inspired my version, the Dracula Unredacted, which was our full unredacted version of Dracula that that Gareth and I wrote, or expanded, I guess. Gareth and I and Brahm wrote it, and takes, again, that same assumption and sort of explicates Stoker's weird contradictions as things that got covered up at the behest of MI6.
Where does the whole like Western mythology of the vampire come from?
Well, there are a lot of fights about that question, but in print, it comes from a series of vampire panics in which people in Serbia and Moravia and areas in sort of the eastern part of Austro-Hungary were reporting that people were coming back up out of the dead and running around the villages, and could someone send a cop? And so Maria Theresa eventually sent some court officials down to investigate these stories of vampirism in her domains, mostly to stop people from saying a bunch of embarrassing peasant superstition where the rest of Europe could make fun of her, which indeed is exactly what happened. These vampire panics got into sort of newsletters and broadsheets that were passed around in sort of the same way that the Weekly World News or BuzzFeed might be now, just as sort of crazy entertainment. And they would, and those sort of filtered into the, at that time, burgeoning and nascent Gothic story tradition. And eventually someone, and that bright spark was probably Charles Maturin with Melmoth the Wanderer, is the guy who sort of takes the vampire signifiers and attaches them to his hero, who at that time is not a vampire. He's just a guy who wanders around and is cursed to live forever and ruin people's lives. But that very, very powerful Gothic image then translates itself over onto the vampire with John Polidori's novel, The Vampire, which is actually him writing mean things about Lord Byron, because the vampire in this case is an aristocrat who uses people and can't be trusted to keep his word about anything, but he always insists that you keep yours. So it's kind of a Polidori borrowing the signifiers out of the Gothic and attaching them to the vampire. So our notion of a vampire is a guy in a cape who is an aristocrat who seduces is very different from the Balkan vampire, who is your Uncle Steve that comes up out of the grave because you buried him backwards and wants to rape all the help and eat all the food in the house. And that's what sort of the Balkan vampire is, sort of a stinking, embarrassing corpse that maybe he attacks you and maybe he does other things, but it's not, you know, he's not the guy who lives up in the castle and predates upon your daughters. They have a version of the vampire in Romania called the Strigoi that stays in his grave, and his spirit comes out in the shape of little lights, and it causes epidemics or infection in the community, and it is used to explain things like tuberculosis outbreaks or just maybe, you know, any other kinds of mysterious wave of deaths that goes through a little village. And they say, oh, that must be the Strigoi. We must have buried someone wrong. There you go. And even in America in 1892, there was a case in Rhode Island called the Essex Vampire, in which people believed that they'd buried someone who was a vampire, and they were giving the community tuberculosis. It was used to explain a tuberculosis outbreak, and they dug the person up and burned their heart. And so that case goes right down to while Stoker is writing. Now, it's unlikely that he saw news reports from rural Rhode Island in his situation, but certainly vampires have by then, this Balkan superstition has gone via Gothic literature into rural Rhode Island, which, you know, they were English settlers. There was no contemporaneous English legend about this sort of thing that happened, the sort of you've buried someone and so they're drinking blood, they're causing bloody disease in the community. That was sort of new and exciting, I think. And so there's a very good book about that called Food for the Dead, by a guy named Michael Bell. And it's, if you want to know about the New England vampire, attacks, he is the guy. And he goes into sort of the origins of that, set of grave superstitions and talks a lot about how it's a Balkan belief originally. He doesn't sort of, I think, connect how it got to Rhode Island. And my theory is that it got there by people reading a bunch of vampire books.
Okay. I have a question for you involving Rhode Island and vampires. Was there any... Do you feel that there's any real literary link between, say, Bram Stoker and H.P. Lovecraft? Like, did Lovecraft crib anything from Dracula? Did Lovecraft read Dracula?
I mean, we know that he read Dracula, or at least talks a good game about reading Dracula, because he mentions it in supernatural horror and literature, and he mentions going to see the film Dracula and being very mad that it doesn't stick to the novel, which much like literally everyone who's ever seen Todd Browning's Dracula, I guess. And so so we have a pretty good idea, and in fact Lovecraft even slurs poor Bram Stoker in one of his letters where he says, I met the woman who claimed to have done the revision work on Stoker's novel and said that the original notes, the original version was a big mess and that she had to cut out a bunch of extra words, which on the one hand is great for my secret history, but on the other hand has no basis in fact whatsoever. Lovecraft probably just met someone through amateur journalism who was talking a good game and didn't have a leg to stand on, but he certainly read Dracula. He was aware of the sort of the topoi of the vampire myth, and that's why when you look in Charles Dexter Ward, when Ward goes off to visit the necromancer, he visits him in Transylvania. He doesn't visit him in anywhere else. Lovecraft is not picking Transylvania out of a hat. It's not, that's where you go to reanimate zombies. He says, this is my Dracula, you know, hat tip. Looking for specific elements out of the story, I mean, Dracula is so much about sex, whether Stoker admits it or not. There's a very funny lecture that Stoker gives later on in his career where he's imploring a novelist to avoid the sex theme because it makes their work look cheap. And it's like, are you Bram Stoker? But that novel is so very much about sexuality of all kinds, and Lovecraft's work is so very not about sexuality of all kinds, that it's hard to think that he would read Dracula and say, I have a real kinship with this work. But he certainly takes some of the gothic trappings from Stoker, as well as from a lot of other people. And there are a lot of vampires that do pop up in Lovecraft's work. The Dunwich Horror feeds on blood. The Kerwin, when he reanimates, he has a series of vampire attacks that are mentioned briefly in the Providence Press. So Lovecraft is, and of course the whole Shambler from the Stars is a vampire that Block brings into the mythos. But the sort of straight up, you know, here is Dracula. Here is a thing that Lovecraft wrote. He doesn't really do a tribute to it in the same way that he does a tribute to the great god Pan in Dunwich Horror, or even Fishhead in Shadow over Innsmouth. It's not a story that I think the central thrust really works for him. And so while the themes of alien invasion, because of course Dracula is very much typified as an alien foreigner who will come and spread his taint all over the city, so that would have, you know, really rhymed with Lovecraft's interests. But the way that he does it is not the way that Lovecraft is interested, because Dracula, although he's mentioned being an alchemist, he doesn't use magic or commune with outside powers. He's just a very dangerous germ, basically. And that's not the way Lovecraft likes to depict his villains.
Well, is there anything that you think people should know about Dracula?
I mean, I think that if they come away knowing, first of all, that the novel is really good, and somewhere people have gotten this notion, and I don't know what it is, people are reading longer novels every day than Dracula, and being very angry that the seventh one in the series hasn't come out, in fact. But Dracula is an amazingly good novel. It's very strong. The opening chapters where Harker goes to Transylvania are, of course, you know, among the strongest, because Dracula is actually on stage. But the setup, the creation of those characters, the way that everyone is painted as some aspect of the valley between science and religion, and that both Mina and Van Helsing, who perfectly unify the two, turn out to be the core of the fight against Dracula. That's very strong. There's a lot of great thematic stuff in it. And it's just a portrait of Victorian self-identity in a way that a lot of other less accessible novels are, but no one wants to, you know, butt their head through George Gissing when you could actually just read Dracula, for God's sake. There's vampires in it. And then if you remember that book Dracula is not Vlad Tepes, has a whole different bunch of stuff that he does and gets into than the historical, as you say, Son of the Dragon did. I think that's a helpful thing to keep you from getting tugged off course. Elizabeth Miller has written a really great book called Dracula Sense and Nonsense that, you know, if you run across anything about Dracula and Elizabeth Miller's name is attached to it, that's the true quill. That's the good stuff. So read her, and secondarily, read me telling you to read her.
Okay. And if, to move away from literature, what are your favorite Dracula movies or movies involving Dracula's?
I mean, vampires. Involving all the Dracula's. My absolute favorite is what we know as Horror of Dracula, but was just Dracula in Britain, the first Hammer Dracula. Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing. It's an amazing film. Terence Fisher directed it as a straight-up war between good and evil, although there's bestiality within Van Helsing, and there's a sort of horrible nobility within Dracula. And Christopher Lee's on screen for like 9 minutes of that movie. And the performance is so indelibly powerful that the fact that the script takes a little too much, in my opinion, from the play, which is a disastrous, terrible play. Certainly a terrible version of the myth. But that Dracula, he's predatory. There's no love interest, which is one of the other terrible things that people added to Dracula. Again, mostly via poor Richard Matheson. That just quality, everything works in that movie super well, and so well that you don't really mind the sort of weird third act turn that the story takes, or the fact that everything's compressed down into basically one zip code instead of set at opposite ends of the European continent the way that the original is. But that's such a fantastic Dracula that it's very, very hard to imagine that there could even be a better one. There's another couple of ones that are sort of fun or good or interesting in their own. Probably one of my other favorites, I don't know if a lot of people have seen, is a movie by Guy Madden, the Canadian weirdo director, called Dracula: Pages from a Virgin's Diary, which is a film of a ballet based on Dracula, but is also very weirdly true to the themes of the book in the way that a lot of other more theoretically straight up Draculas aren't. Because, for example, Dracula's very, I mean, they cast a Chinese dancer as Dracula, so he's very much the alien who has come among these poor British people to destroy them. It's the notion of putting it as a ballet means that you're just looking at emotional beats and high points. Madden sort of weird expressionist filmmaking works perfectly for the story. It's just, and the music is Mahler, so it's great right there. I'm a big fan of that movie. I would not gun anyone down who either bounces off it because it's ballet Dracula, what are you talking about, or just because they can't wrap their head around Madden. But I think if you're really interested in the book, that is a great Dracula to take on board. But, you know, you're never going to go wrong with Christopher Lee. That's my motto.
Cool. I don't have any more questions, Ken, but is there anything that you want people to find out about or anything that you want to plug? Or,
I mean, I can plug Tour to Lovecraft, which is my book about Lovecraft stories, Tour to Lovecraft the Tales. And I am, as we speak, expanding that and finishing the sequel, Tour to Lovecraft the Destinations, both of which will be out from Atomic Overmind Press a little later this year, maybe in the spring sometime. And so that will be a that will be my next contribution to the world of Lovecraft scholarship. Is maybe too grand a word, Lovecraft study, I'll say. And then I'll see, you know, hopefully you and everyone at Necronomicon in 2019, because I will be a guest there, and it'll be great fun to go back to Providence and touch all the Lovecraft stuff again.
Yeah, no, I got to make it out to Providence one of these days. I always just do the Portland one because that's in my backyard.
Right, yeah. The Portland Film Fest, of course, is so magical and glorious in its own right. Certainly people should come out to that. But yeah, the Providence one is the full Lovecraft convention. There's panels and speeches and guest stars, and it's a magnificent time. And, you know, August in Providence, Rhode Island is probably, it's a better place to spend August than most places are, I think.
Well, thank you, Ken, talking some Dracula, and again, thank you so much.
No, thank you, DB. Thanks for having me on. Happy to do it anytime.